And we'll return now to the story of the day, the capture of Saddam Hussein. Next, we're going to review his astonishing career. Saddam ruled Iraq for nearly a quarter century, taking the nation into disastrous wars, first with Iran and then with the United States and its allies. NPR's Mike Schuster has this look back on the career of Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein was the preeminent strongman in Iraq since the late 1960s, but his name did not become a household word in the United States until August 2, 1990, when he launched his army on a blitzkrieg attack against Kuwait. In response, the United States built up a military force 500,000 strong in Saudi Arabia and in the waters of the Persian Gulf, and President George Bush gave the orders to go to war against Iraq on January 16, 1991.
Tonight, 28 nations, countries from five continents, Europe and Asia, Africa and the Arab League, have forces in the Gulf area standing shoulder to shoulder against Saddam Hussein. These countries had hoped the use of force could be avoided. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
Saddam Hussein also took to the airwaves that night to appeal to all Arabs everywhere to rise up against the United States in the great battle between the Arab world and the infidels.
At 2:30 a.m. tonight, on the 16th of January, the treacherous foes and Bush the Satan has perpetrated his crime. He and the criminal Zionism, and the great battle has been initiated, the mother of all battles.
The mother of all battles proved to be short-lived. Allied warplanes pounded Iraq and Iraqi forces in Kuwait for nearly 2 months. Then a ground invasion took back Kuwait in 100 hours, leaving tens of thousands of Iraqis killed, but only 500 Allied deaths. Saddam Hussein's life was permeated by violence, in wars, in coups successful and unsuccessful, in assassination, treachery, and terrorism. Born in the central Iraqi town of Tikrit in 1936, Saddam learned violence at an early age. By the time he was a teenager, his biographers say he had carried out his first killing, the murder of a communist militant, the weapon, a knife. In 1959, he was a member of the hit squad that sought to assassinate Iraq's military leader, Abdel Karim Qasem. Qasem's car was riddled with bullets, but he survived. Saddam was wounded in the leg and fled to Cairo. He returned to Iraq a few years later and began to organize gangs for the rising Ba'ath Party. When the Ba'ath took power in 1968, Saddam became Iraq's second most powerful leader, turning his gangs into an intricate array of secret police organizations that would eventually infiltrate every aspect of Iraq's political life. Saddam took the supreme spot for himself in 1979, eliminating his rivals in a power grab captured on videotape. The scene was a meeting of Iraq's Revolutionary Command Council. Kenan Makia is the author of a study of Saddam's Iraq, Republic of Fear.
You have a cigar-smoking Saddam Hussein in the beginning, chairing the session, and then beginning to read out a speech in which he suddenly announces, to the amazement of his audience, that this huge conspiracy has been detected at various levels. And then he calls out people's names, and you can see them standing up in bewilderment and then being taken out of the hall. He then goes and sits down in the front ranks, and one of the alleged conspirators gets up and details a whole long confession as to how he actually did participate in this obviously fabricated conspiracy.
Those who were taken out of the hall were shot by those who had allied themselves with Saddam. A year later, Saddam made the first of his great political miscalculations. With the Islamic Revolution only a year old in neighboring Iran, Saddam ordered his troops to invade. The Iran-Iraq war lasted for 8 years and eventually ended in stalemate. Saddam called it the Second Qadisiyah, a reference to the battle in the 7th century, in which an Arab conquering army brought Islam to Persia. This betrayed his enormous ambitions to be the great leader who unites all Arabs into one of the world's richest and most powerful nations. Oil and arms would be the means. Saddam spent billions to acquire an enormous arsenal, which would include an effort to obtain nuclear weapons. And, Kenan Makia says, the people of Iraq would see concrete benefits from this effort.
He built the infrastructure of this country like no other regime had. This was, of course, made possible by oil revenues. One way or another, he frog-marched the country into very high attention to literacy, built universities all over the place, put enormous investment into technocratic technical elite, which was his military complex.
But the war with Iran put enormous strains on the economy of Iraq. Saddam needed more resources, and in 1990, he seized Kuwait and its oil fields, claiming that Kuwait was actually a province of Iraq. The invasion of Kuwait was Saddam's second great political and military miscalculation, says Andrew Parasoliti, director of the Middle East Initiative at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard.
I think that Saddam Hussein believed that the United States suffered from the Vietnam syndrome, that he didn't believe that the United States had the military capability or will, more importantly, or will to mount a sustained military attack on Iraq, and that the first American casualties would divide the United States or undermine political will to conduct this operation.
The Gulf War devastated Iraq and nearly toppled Saddam. In the north, the Kurds rose up against his rule, and in the south, Shiite Muslims rebelled. Saddam unleashed his military on both. The United States looked the other way, and Saddam retained power in Baghdad. After that, says Andrew Parasoliti, Saddam could no longer cast himself as the modern-day Saladin, who defeated the Crusaders and captured Jerusalem in the name of Islam 800 years ago.
After the defeat in the Kuwait War, I think that Saddam's ambitions became more limited. The war caused him to focus on survival. The devastating military defeat in the war, the uprising that took place in 1991, these were signals to him that his position was not as secure as he might have hoped.
In the years after the Gulf War, Saddam continued to fight the U.S. and the West, but it was a more subtle war. It involved a hide-and-seek game with U.N. weapons inspectors over whether Iraq retained chemical and biological weapons, and it involved an international propaganda struggle over economic sanctions, which the United Nations imposed in part to rid Iraq of its prohibited weapons. Saddam proved as intransigent on this issue as he had on all others, and it brought a confrontation with another U.S. president, Bill Clinton, who ordered the four-day bombing of Iraq in December 1998.
I am convinced the decision I made to order this military action, though difficult, was absolutely the right thing to do. It is in our interest and in the interest of people all around the world. Saddam Hussein has used weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles before. I have no doubt he would use them again if permitted to develop them.
As he did after the Gulf War, Saddam cast this too as a victory for Iraq.
We had only very light losses, thanks be to God. This has been a failed attempt by the Americans. May God have mercy on our martyrs. God is most great. God is most great.
After decades in power, Saddam Hussein was forced out of Baghdad with astonishing speed. Just a few weeks after the U.S. military began its assault on Iraq last March, the Iraqi leader and his loyalists disappeared. He issued an occasional defiant message in the months that followed, and his disappearance was a constant embarrassment to the Bush administration, as was the absence of any evidence that weapons of mass destruction remained in Iraq. But his time as a fugitive ended without resistance. The former dictator who covered Iraq with monuments to himself was hiding in a hole, accompanied only by a pair of assistants and a taxicab. Mike Schuster, NPR News.